We had a what's called a pre-NDA meeting with FDA last week. And so we hope by around August or so, we should have everything submitted to FDA. And then we hope by around June of 2024, we should have, if all goes well, FDA approval. Now, there's a big difference between FDA approval and patient access. So I want to add another couple things about that have been going really, really well.
Welcome, Rick Doblin, to the MAPS Canada podcast.
Well, Luke, I'm glad to participate. It's great.
Awesome. So got a little bio here, although really it should be, you know, if you're watching this, this is MAPS Canada. But anyway, Rick Doblin, PhD, is the founder and president of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, aka MAPS, which you should have heard of, which is founded in 1986. MAPS is a nonprofit organization that provides public education, research, and policy reform towards the legal, responsible, and evidence-based use of psychedelics. Rick has dedicated 50 years of his life towards this mission, and MAPS now leads the way towards creating legal context for the beneficial use of psychedelics on an international scale. We're MAPS Canada, which is a sister organization to the US-based MAPS, just to clarify. So welcome, Rick, my friend.
Great, Luke.
So there's a lot of things to talk about, a lot of exciting announcements recently with the phase three studies that MAPS has been going through. And I think I'd like to provide a little bit of context. We're intending this to go out for people who haven't heard anything about clinical trials or drug policy before. So I'm going to provide a little bit of context, and I've got a question for you. Okay. So for people, so they know, for something like SSRIs to be available, they first had to have gone through clinical trials, which tests a drug on human beings. And in the US, there are three phases to clinical trials, phases one, two, and three. Phase one, as I understand it, tests the substance in people for safety primarily as like initial tests. Stage two tests for safety and efficacy, including things like optimal dosing. And phase three tests for safety and efficacy on a larger scale, amongst other things that would need to be worked out. Once phase three is completed, which is the key stage, you can apply to the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, for approval so the drug can be prescribed by doctors legally. So Rick, when it comes to MDMA-assisted therapy, where are we at right now, if we have any announcements, and where are we headed?
Okay, well, where we're at now is the culmination of 37 years of effort and roughly $200 million that has been spent to bring us to the point of two successful phase three studies. Phase three studies are the final stage of research to make a drug into a prescription medicine where you try to prove safety and efficacy. What I'll say, though, just to go back in time a little bit to give you a sense of where we're really at, is that from 1985, when MDMA was criminalized, 1986 is when I started MAPS. We had five protocols all rejected up until 1992, when the FDA approved our first study, which they approved as a phase one dose response safety study in experienced ecstasy users, because they didn't want anybody naive to get, quote, addicted to ecstasy.
Right.
That took us through the 90s, much of the 90s. And then in 1999, 2000, we tried to start a study for MDMA for PTSD in Spain. And that study was going pretty well in its early stages. We got some good media coverage, and then it was shut down for political reasons. The National Institute on Drug Abuse had sent one of its MDMA neurotoxicity researchers, George Riccardi, to Spain to speak about the dangers of MDMA. You know, research could potentially get in the way of the narrative that MDMA is terrible and people should go to jail, you know, massive periods of time. But once that study was shut down, super frustrating, we managed to start MDMA research in the U.S. around 2003. And four was the first person ever treated, 2004. And that took us till 2016, these phase two studies. And November 29th, 2016, we got permission to go to phase three. But we didn't do that because there's a lot of methodological questions about how do you do a double-blind study with drugs that if you take it, you know you've taken it, or at least usually you do. And so we engaged in what's called a special protocol assessment process. And that took us about another 8 months. And that was negotiating with FDA on the design of the study, the statistical analysis plan, all the other studies that the FDA would want to see as part of this, what's called an NDA, New Drug Application Review process. And so we negotiated all that, and we ended up with what's called an agreement letter. And my understanding of this process is that the agreement letter means that we have come to agreement on the clinical design, and that FDA can no longer object to the design for any reason because they've approved it. In addition, they're bound to approve the drug if we get statistically significant evidence of efficacy, if no new safety problems have arisen, and if we generate the data in acceptable ways. So we did have no new safety problems arise. Also, you know, MDMA has been taken by tens of millions of people for over 40, 50 years, so that there's, you know, enormous body of information about MDMA. We did get statistically significant evidence of efficacy. And we've just been inspected by FDA and Health Canada a couple months ago, very rigorous inspections of all the data, and they liked the way, you know, they had some suggestions here and there, but overall, we passed the inspection. All right, so what that means is now that we have two very, very successful phase three studies, that we are gathering the final information and stuff to submit to FDA. We had a what's called a pre-NDA meeting with FDA last week, and that reviewed all the plans and what FDA wanted to see and where we're at. That looked great. And so we hope by around August or so, we should have everything submitted to FDA. And then we hope by around June of 2024, we should have, if all goes well, FDA approval. Now, there's a big difference between FDA approval and patient access. So I want to add another couple things about that have been going really, really well. So the first thing that's obvious to everybody that knows what we're doing is that psychedelic psychotherapy sessions are not like one-hour sessions. You know, the normal billing for insurance companies for psychotherapy is like 1 hour. But an MDMA session can be 8 hours. And, you know, psilocybin can be 5 or 6 hours. So MAPS, in association with Compass Pathways, the psilocybin company, worked together to lobby the American Medical Association on trying to get a longer billing code for psychedelic therapy sessions. And the AMA said yes, they approved it. So January 1, 2024, there's going to be a new billing. We also just put out a press release about the long-term follow-up. Now, not that long-term, 6 months minimum, sometimes a year, sometimes more than a year, to the people that were in our first phase three study. And what we demonstrated was that the results were durable. So, yeah, because we did demonstrate the results are durable, that's really encouraging, again, for insurance coverage. Other aspects are challenging also. So that once, because this MDMA is currently a Schedule I drug, that once FDA says yes, if they do say yes, to making MDMA into a prescription medicine with therapy, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, has 90 days to reschedule, to move it out of Schedule 1 into some other schedule. We hope Schedule 3 or Schedule 4. We don't want Schedule 2 and don't think it deserves to be in Schedule 2, so we're very much hoping for Schedule 3 or Schedule 4.
Could you explain what Schedule 3, 4, or 2 means?
Yeah. So Schedule 1 is high potential for abuse, no currently accepted safety under medical supervision, and no currently accepted medical use. These are the drugs like that are the most controlled. Schedule 2 is for drugs that have high potential for abuse but have demonstrated medical use, currently accepted medical use. Like, for example, cocaine, certain opiates and things are in Schedule 2.
Got it.
They're tracked really well. When somebody prescribes a Schedule 2 drug, a prescription, triplicate prescriptions, one of them has to go to the DEA. So they keep track of everybody who's actually prescribing it. And you can't really give renewable prescriptions. They have to be new prescriptions. So it's the most rigorous. Schedule 3 is considered to be drugs that have less than a high potential for abuse and have a currently accepted medical use and accepted safety under medical supervision. There's not that much difference between Schedule 3 and Schedule 4. Schedule 5, and then you have over-the-counter drugs. These are just related to the abuse liability, how much controls there are. And the really interesting news for us, which is great, which is that we have a top-notch team to work with us to try to negotiate with FDA. It's the FDA-controlled substances staff that comes up with what they call the eight-factor analysis about the abuse liability, and they negotiate with the DEA, Office of Diversion Control, about what schedules to recommend. And we have a great team. But recently, there's a woman, Rachel Neuer, who was a New York Times reporter, and she's just come out with a book on MDMA, which I recommend to people. It's called I Feel Love. A great title for MDMA. But for her book, she wanted to interview some of the DEA people that had been involved in the hearings from 84 to 86, where the DEA was trying to criminalize MDMA, and where I tried to stop them and went to DEA headquarters in August of 84 and asked for a hearing. And I had gone through a really important psychedelic experience in part to work on my own shadow, the parts of myself that I disown, things like that, in order to be a more effective advocate struggling up against the DEA. And so, I was able to have some interesting discussions with the DEA people, and in particular one named Frank Sapienza, who wrote in an article in Newsweek in 1985 that I took them totally by surprise, that they only knew about ecstasy. They didn't know about therapeutic use of MDMA. And so when I walked in with a legal support and witnesses and all this about therapists wanting to preserve the therapeutic use of MDMA, saying it should be in Schedule 3, right. We just took them by surprise. So this fellow Frank Sapienza, I knew we were just collateral damage, in their efforts to go after ecstasy. And so we had a personable relationship, even though he was, on the other side. And it sort of made it easier for me, too, because I felt like we were winning the lawsuit, which we did win, although the DEA rejected the recommendation of the administrative law judge and kept it in Schedule 1, which is basically why I started MAPS. To bring it through the FDA. But in any case, Rachel wanted to interview early DEA officials. And the fellow from the headquarters, Gene Haslip, who really led the effort, is no longer alive. But Frank Sapienza, I thought, I'll see if he's alive. And I found him on LinkedIn. And it turns out that he no longer works for DEA, but he consults with pharma companies who want to reschedule drugs. So I wrote him a letter on or a message on LinkedIn, and I said that this woman, Rachel Neuer, wanted to interview him for her book, but also that we had progressed all this time and we had two successful phase 3 studies, and would he be interested in working with our team to help us reschedule MDMA? And then I reminded him of the quote in Newsweek where he said we took him by surprise, and I said, you weren't really against the therapeutic use, you were just against recreational, and now we've made all this progress. Would you help us? And to my utter shock, the very next day, he wrote back, and he said, I remember you, I remember all these hearings, and yes, I will be glad to help you. And so we now have Frank Sapienza, who was part of the team to criminalize MDMA in the first place, is now part of the team to help us negotiate with DEA and FDA about what schedule it should go in.
Yeah, the irony is hilarious.
Yeah.
And really speaks to when you have the truth on your side, that eventually people see things differently and they come to your side.
Yeah, I think there's another thing about that eventually. Yeah, sometimes it takes a long time.
37 years, right? That's quite a while. But in the thousands of years of, tens of thousands of years of human history, maybe it's not that much time in the long run.
I think that's a really good point, because human evolution is extremely slow. in terms of cultural evolution, and also in terms of, well, cultural evolution can be a little bit faster, but you look at some of the things from the Greeks from 2,000 years ago, you know, the Plato dialogues and all these things, and they don't seem that different from us today. We've not really evolved in emotional and spiritual ways. Our mind and our technology has evolved in miraculous ways. I mean, the fact that you and I can be talking right now from such different locations, and we can see each other and we can hear each other. It's mind-boggling. It's miraculous. The technology advances have not been equaled by advances in our emotional and spiritual maturity. And that's why we're destroying the world with these technologies and climate change and species extinction and incredible weapons of war. And so I think that we have a long way to go, and that I think psychedelics can play a major role in helping our species collectively and individuals individually to move to a different perspective. And I think that that different perspective is one where we recognize that on a deeper level, we're all in this together, and that, you know, we have fundamentally more in similar with each other than different, and that we should move more towards collective action, which is necessary, and not be so scared of the stranger. And I think psychedelics can play a major role in that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I saw a Facebook post from your old time mentor, Stanislav Grof, where he was encouraging people in the wake of the war in Ukraine to undergo their own holotropic breathwork sessions as part of like a collective like processing of this new trauma that's coming up in the world. And so it seems there's quite a call to doing the inner work to address the things that cause all these problems. Absolutely, like psychedelics are an incredible tool for this, and we're seeing the hard evidence for that in these trials. So it's really exciting. Yeah. What's coming in the future?
Yeah, I think so. You
know, and speaking of the future, also, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to talk about the future in a sense, in that really we want to globalize access.
So. Mm. So, you
know, not just in the U.S., but even in Canada.
Yes, and please, please.
And Israel, because, you know, we purposely arranged our phase 3 studies to have sites in Israel and Canada.
Yeah.
So that once FDA says yes, we think Health Canada and the Ministry of Health in Israel will follow very shortly. So for one, you know, for the studies, we'll get 3 countries out of it, and then potentially more.
Awesome. And in your opinion, as a Canadian, what country do you think will approve MDMA first, and why? Is it like the US, Canada, UK, Europe, Israel? What do you think?
Hey, we hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. Now, if you want to support and become part of the psychedelic movement, feel free to donate to MAPS Canada at the link in the description below. Thank you for helping our mission to support equitable access to legal and regulated psychedelic medicines for all Canadians.
Well, it's interesting to talk about England for a minute. MHRA, their Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency. The people in England are desperate to show that something good happened from Brexit. You know, it looks like it's really hurt their country a lot.
Yeah.
And it was sold under a false bill of goods, and they're really struggling. But one of the things that they're considering is that they, now that they're free from the European Medicines Agency, there's a possibility that they might approve drugs before even the FDA, certainly before the European Medicines Agency. So our challenge is that we've you know, got to raise a bunch more money to really go full speed ahead in Europe, but it could be potentially that MHRA goes before even FDA if we submit a full package to them. It's also the case that all the regulatory agencies in the world, mostly other than EMA, European Medicines Agency, do look to the FDA. So we think that the FDA is likely to be first. I've been working today on studies potentially in Brazil, in Australia, various places in Europe. So we do really want to globalize. And so I think we're in a tremendous situation right now that has been the results of almost four decades of work, and as I said, almost $200 million. And there's 13 million PTSD patients in the United States. So our key challenge, I think, is going to be to train more therapists. So if there are people listening that are interested in becoming psychedelic therapists, that's really what we need.
And they can check the link in the description to learn more about MAPS and the training process and MAPS Canada's involvement. So they can check that out.
That would be great. Because actually we are considering partnering to some extent with a company, Numinous, in British Columbia, near Vancouver. And they're talking with us about the possibility of creating a legal context for therapists to receive MDMA as part of their training in a therapeutic setting. We think that's one of the very best training tools that we have. And so we are hoping that Numinous and MAPS will come to an agreement, or MAPS Public Benefit Corp will come to an agreement, and that we will be able to send hundreds or potentially even thousands of therapists to Canada to receive MDMA at a fraction of the cost of what it would involve if we did it in the U.S., under an FDA protocol or something like that. So, we're very much collaborating in Canada. But I'll say that that there's several symbolic. So in order to have the psychedelic renaissance, we're telling a cultural story. It's a lot of symbolism in the storytelling. And so I felt that there were two things that were essential in order to really have people understand that there was a psychedelic renaissance. The first one was to start research, at Harvard, because that's where Timothy Leary was. Mm. And so, as I said, burying the ghost of Timothy Leary. And we managed to accomplish that around 2006. With a project for MDMA for cancer patients. So that was great at Harvard. The other thing was that we had to start LSD research, LSD being the quintessential scary psychedelic. And so right around 2008, we managed to start LSD research in Switzerland, where Albert Hoffman and Anita Hoffman lived. And that this was, again, LSD for people with anxiety and depression related to life-threatening illnesses. But only recently I've become, well, not that recently, maybe 5-10 years ago, I became aware that there's one more symbolic thing that would really, really show that the psychedelic renaissance is here, and that involves Canada. And that involves the Allen Memorial Institute, which is connected to McGill in Montreal. Mm. So Allen Memorial Institute, I did speak there also. But they were the place of the worst excesses of the CIA MK-Ultra mind control stuff with psychedelics. Mm. So it was the president of the American Psychiatric Association, who was also president of the Canadian Psychiatric Association, who was, I think it was Dr. Cameron, who was in charge of the Allen Memorial Institute, late 50s, early 60s. And this is where we were trying to figure out about the use of LSD for brainwashing and for disorienting people. And so they did a bunch of horrible things of taking postpartum women and others and giving them a series of electroshocks therapy with LSD to destroy their personalities and make them pre-verbal and then try to build them up. So I thought trying, and the Canadian government was sued, and it was a terrible disaster. And if you go see Allen Memorial Institute, it took place, 60 plus years ago. But the last time I checked, it was like number two or three of the paragraph of what it says about the Allen Memorial Institute. It's a horrible legacy to overcome. And so it would be really good if they start doing therapeutic studies with psychedelics for public benefit instead of the mind control. So I'd say that is the last little symbolic thing. I did try that. We did have a site in Montreal for our phase three sites, but nobody at McGill would connect with us. You have to have institutional affiliation. And we ended up working with a woman, Emma Hapke, at the University of Toronto. So we had an affiliation with the University of Toronto to approve a study in Montreal because the people at McGill would not be involved, in part because of this horrible legacy of the Allen Memorial Institute.
Right. Got it. That's so, yeah, that's crazy. I actually didn't know that. Yeah. I mean, we're over here on the West Coast, a little bit far away, but yeah, that's interesting. So it's good that you spoke there at least.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was really hopeful when I spoke there that maybe they would be open to doing a study.
Yeah. Also before, by the way, I laughed a bit at the Brexit thing because I'm a British citizen. So if any good could have come from our decision to exit, then that would be great. Waiting for some good to come out of that. But,
you know, what a self-inflicted wound. It was so bad. And, you know, America, just to say this about the debt ceiling and the debt crisis, we may, who knows what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks, but we're at this stage where we may inflict a potentially even worse wound than Brexit on America if we don't pay our bills.
Yeah, I'm hoping Canada doesn't have the same debt problem, but it seems like we at least have inflation. So, well, speaking of debt and finances, Sabrina, one of our board members, co-chair, shared with me some stats that it takes a drug on average, or whatever the stat is, about 15 years and $1 to $2 billion to go from the beginning of testing to approval for MDMA-assisted therapy. Does that seem accurate? And how important is it for MAPS to get more funds to get this project through the finish line and beyond FDA approval to get this done right?
Well, it's essential that we get funds to get to FDA approval. And then the next step is what we're calling sustainability, or other people call that profitability. That's where the income from the sale of MDMA, you know, covers our expenses so that then we're a sustainable operation. And so we're currently working with a number of about $80 million to get to FDA approval, and perhaps something similar to that once that FDA approval happens to get to profitability, sustainability. But once you have FDA approval, then there's so many different options to raise funds. You know, royalty shares, loans even, selling off rights to other countries to develop MDMA, like the Japanese or the Koreans or something. So really what we're thinking is that we just want to get to FDA approval. And beyond that, we'll have all sorts of other choices and opportunities to raise funds. So we're thinking it's around $80 million. We think that, as I said, there's a big difference between FDA approval and also patient access. So another thing, for example, is that, you know, FDA says, yes, DEA reschedules within 3 months, 90 days, but then the states have to reschedule. And so half the states automatically reschedule, and a bunch of states require a law to be passed, like California, New York, Colorado. So we're working to get these laws passed. So we've got to do all sorts of things with Board of Pharmacy and this and that in different states to make it so that once FDA approval happens, once DEA rescheduling happens, that the state rescheduling happens, then we get insurance and then we have enough trained therapists. That's and then we have all of the infrastructure to track all the outcomes. I think that there's a good chance that we will have a patient registry. And so there's a lot of record keeping and things like that just to be tracking for side effects. So yeah, we do need resources, but when I started MAPS in 1986, it wasn't for 28 years later in 2014 that I changed my mind. I thought originally that MDMA would automatically go generic because it was invented by Merck in 1912 and it's in the public domain. And then MDMA was used for PTSD in the late 70s, early 80s, before I even learned about MDMA. So, you know, we have no right to patent the use of MDMA for PTSD, so, or for anything else. So I just thought that it would immediately go generic. And I didn't realize until 28 years later that the FDA has this program to provide incentives for developing drugs that are off patent. And these incentives are called data exclusivity. So we have exclusive use of our data for what will be 5.5 years, and then the FDA can start the review of generic competitors and however long that takes. it takes an average of over 2 years, but it doesn't seem like it should be that long for MDMA. It's a very stable molecule. It's not that hard to make.
So data exclusivity, I understand, so I'm not from this background, so I can sort of speak to the viewers who don't have this background. The patent means that it's like the substance itself is patented, it's exclusive, they can make it, and then at some point it becomes generic. What does it mean to have data exclusivity?
Okay, so you need to get a drug approved by the FDA or by European Medicines Agency, and you automatically get it. So if your drug has never been approved before, you get 5 years data exclusivity. If it has been approved before, in whole or in part. So for example, cannabis, THC is a medicine, CBD is a medicine. So if we make cannabis in flower form into a medicine, we'd only get 3 years data exclusivity. Then you get another 6 months if you do what are called pediatric studies. And so many people are surprised to learn that the FDA has required us to study adolescents with PTSD if we succeed first in adults. And then you automatically get the 6 months data exclusivity, even if your studies fail to show that it should be marketed in adolescents. You just have to do the studies. And then there's this period of time, again, that it takes the FDA to review a generic application. So it's 5.5 years plus, let's say, year and a half, something like that. In Europe, they developed this similar program for data exclusivity, but they did it years after the United States did it in 1984. And so they realized that that's not that long of a time, so they gave 10 years for data exclusivity and market exclusivity. The difference, fundamental difference between this and a patent is that other companies can develop their own data if they want to for MDMA, for PTSD. What we're doing doesn't block anybody from doing anything. Whereas a patent would block them not from doing the research, but from marketing it. So that's where the data exclusivity really comes in, about this commercial protection against generics. And the reason that we're willing to consider that is that, you know, it's been hard to raise money for research. And we've often been slowed down for lack of money. It's been a delicate dance. You know, we have raised over $145 million now in grants and donations in our 37-year history, which is an awful lot of money. But it has been challenging to do that. And so the thought was that if we have this data exclusivity, then we can charge prices above generic, make money, and then use that money to fund other research, or it's for patient assistance programs, or to give back to MAPS for our drug policy reform efforts, or whatever. So that's where in 2014, we created the MAPS Public Benefit Corp as a public benefit psychedelic pharmaceutical company. And the reason that public benefit is important is that it's a modification of capitalism. Capitalism feels like cancer. You know, it's like grow without any limits. And a lot of times cancers grow, and then they kill the host.
Right.
All right. So what capitalism seems to be doing is grow, and we're killing the planet. And people are offloading what are called externalities, you know, external costs to the commons, privatizing the gains for individuals. And so we wanted to innovate in two different ways. One is this idea of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. But then the other is how to market a pharmaceutical drug. And so the Public Benefit Corp, you maximize public benefit, not profit. And I think that's the way all of our healthcare should be.
That's awesome.
And so that's our corporate structure. And right now, MAPS is the 100% owner of the Public Benefit Corp, but that may change within weeks or a month or so, in that we need a bunch of money to get back to your question, to get to FDA approval. And so far, we've not received it from donors. And we do have some investors wanting to invest, but I'm not so thrilled about the Public Benefit Corp becoming publicly traded. I just think that the focus on consciousness change, you know, mass mental health, spiritualized humanity, public benefit, I think will shift more in the direction of return to shareholders if we're a publicly traded company.
Got it. Yeah, that dancing that fine line dance of operating within the system to try to change the system towards something better is sort of the history of maps, and that resonates. That seems to make sense. So that's awesome, and I'm excited to see how those shifts will lead to shifts in Canada. But let's shift topics for a second. So coming up soon, it's now May 16th that we're recording this, we've got Psychedelic Science 2023 coming up. What can people expect, so people know, is a conference put on by MAPS in the US. So what can people expect, and why is this a must attend for this year?
I'll give you again a bit of history. So the first Psychedelic Science Conference was in 2010. And this was, again, this idea of bringing all the researchers together. But at the time, it was only nonprofits. This was the Beckley Foundation in England with Amanda Fielding, Bob Jesse's Council on Spiritual Practices, Dave Nichols, George Greer, Charlie Grobe, and others with Hefter Research Institute and MAPS. And so we gathered everybody together in 2010. We had about 400 or so people. It was really great. The next one was 2013 in Oakland. We had well over 1,000 people. That was really terrific at the Oakland Convention Center. 2017, we did it again at the Oakland Convention Center, and it was 3,000 people total. And that was the largest psychedelic conference that has ever happened, both before and since. And so we waited 6 years, actually, to do this next big collaborative psychedelic science conference. And the reason we waited is because I wanted there to be a real sense that there was some new chapter about to open with psychedelics, a doorway to a new world. Something was fundamentally different, and also we are slowed down by COVID, you know, which shut things down for quite a while. But the new doorway to the future is now that we are on the verge, we think, of potential FDA approval for MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD. Two companies, USONA, a nonprofit, and Compass Pathways, a for-profit, are getting close. Compass has started its phase three studies. USONA is getting close to starting its phase three studies. We think that they'll be several years behind us with, 2026 or so, you know, something like that, maybe 2027, 26, for approval for psilocybin. So the idea here is that the culture has changed. There's hundreds now of for-profit psychedelic companies that didn't used to exist. I mentioned that MAPS has raised about $145 million in grants and donations and around $63 million or so in investments of different kinds, royalty shares and convertible notes. That so we haven't sold any of our equity yet in the Public Benefit Corp. We have been able to, move to phase three studies, succeeding. And so we thought that this is really time for this conference. And we went into Colorado. And one of the advantages of Colorado is that, and our idea of mass mental health and spiritualized humanity has two basic strategies that are synchronous and that mutually reinforcing. The one is medicalization through the FDA. The one is legalization through drug policy reform. And so Colorado, Denver was the first city to make mushrooms the lowest enforcement priority. And that started other cities, and then that led eventually to the Oregon Psilocybin Initiative. And then in November, in Colorado, they passed the Natural Plant Medicine Initiative to legalize Ibogaine. San Pedro, DMT,
peyote.
Peyote. I don't know if they did peyote. I think they may have left peyote, but San Pedro.
There's that controversy around that, wasn't there? Church.
Yes, the Native American Church didn't want peyote to be included because they worry that it's scarce and that might even upset the government because they've got religious use of peyote. So what though has happened is that has passed. Psychedelics have been decriminalized in Colorado, and we outgrew the Oakland Convention Center. So now we have the entire Denver Convention Center. We have over 200 companies with exhibits.
Wow.
Amazing. And we have over 7,000 people coming. So this is more than twice as large as the largest prior psychedelic conference in the history that we're aware of.
Yeah.
All right. So if somebody comes to this conference, you are going to get the best opportunity to understand what's going on with the entire field, both from the series of talks. We have 11 different tracks. There's going to be all sorts of simultaneous things going on. It'll be very difficult. And the good news is that because we've reached such a legitimacy, you could say, through our research, through drug policy forum, that the governor of Colorado is going to open the conference.
Wow. Amazing. That's exciting.
Amazing. Well, even more amazing is that once I heard that the governor was going to open the conference, I reached out to former governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who is also Trump's Secretary of Energy. Mm. And I said, we need a bipartisan opening. Would you speak? And he agreed to do it. So now we have the governor, Democratic governor of Colorado, opening the conference, and then followed by the former Republican governor of Texas, also welcoming us and, you know, supporting the work with psychedelics moving forward. So the conference itself, we've got Josh Gordon, who's the head of the National Institute of Mental Health. We have Tom Insel, the former head of National Institute of Mental Health, Paul Summergrad, the former president of the American Psychiatric Association, Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote the book, The Body Keeps the Score. We've got Aaron Rodgers, the quarterback,
Melissa
interviewed
Etheridge.
By Aubrey Marcus. What?
Melissa Etheridge, the
Melissa Etheridge.
It's going to be three times Grammy winning artist, something like that.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing. So over 300 speakers. And the first 2 days, the 19th and 20th, are for experiential days, workshops. Stan Groff is going to come with Brigida, his wife, and they're going to do 240 people in a breathwork session, one of the world's largest breathwork sessions. Incredible. And then the conference itself starts the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday with all the talks. And so there's going to be a lot of opportunity for networking, a lot of opportunity for people to meet each other and think about what they can do together. So, and it's going to be, in a way, a big celebration for the cultural transformation that has taken place, where we would have a conference like this with two, you know, governors opening the conference. Amazing.
Yeah. The bipartisan presence there is also symbolic, too, that this isn't like a political thing. This is a health thing. This is a deeper issue. And everyone's rallying around.
Yeah, we're actually one of the very few things that has risen above the culture wars.
Yeah. It's hard to... You made the right call with MDMA and PTSD for veterans. It's really hard to argue with that.
very much.
Well, and
look, we like to say that we don't do science, we do political science. So that was very well chosen. You know, what's the patient population? What's the drug? How do we move through all the resistance and fear that's built up in the population? That's why I'm so glad to be talking to you, because public education through podcasts is one of the most important things we can do now to sort of prepare people for what's coming with information, with stories that they can tell others, and to really spread the word so people are not taken by surprise and like, oh my God, psychedelics are prescribed now. You know, it's something that we're trying to telegraph, you know, well ahead of time for months and years ahead of time.
Absolutely. And it's amazing to be a part of it, too, and play my part with my experience with YouTube and helping out Maps Canada with the podcast. And
it's great.
Yeah. And it's interesting being a part of the new generation of enthusiasts, advocates for psychedelics, to sort of see the history and to just come into it not too long ago, after all this work has been done. So I'm curious, what's something that my generation didn't witness in the decades prior that you feel would be wise for us to know?
Huh. Well, the incredible unfair repression of psychedelic research that wiped out science for multiple decades. You know, when there was this move against the counterculture and the hippies, and, you know, John Ehrlichman, who was Nixon's domestic policy advisor, said that Nixon had two main enemies, the hippies and the blacks and the civil rights movement. And they couldn't object to their protesting, but what they could do is object to the drugs that they used, and that they could criminalize them and use them to arrest their leaders, break up their meetings. And Ehrlichman said, did we know we are exaggerating the risk of these drugs? Yeah, of course we did. So I think that your generation may not be aware of how Timothy Leary was tried to put in jail for some seeds, marijuana seeds. They tried to put him in jail for years.
Yeah.
That not only was the backlash against the non-medical use, but we managed to stamp out scientific research all over the world. And this was at a time where MAPS was not existent, and the U.S. government was sort of at the height of its powers in terms of our place in the world, and we were able to export this kind of repression of psychedelic research all over the world. And it took me multiple decades. So it's a tragedy to think about what we're coming forward with now that was could have been forward 50 years ago, and all of the mental health conditions that could have been treated that were not. Again, because these drugs were researched, were suppressed, and research was blocked. So I think that's one thing. The other thing is actually, I just was at a restaurant the other day, and this young woman came up to me and recognized me and said that she's interested in becoming a psychedelic therapist and that I'd inspired her and stuff. And so it was really nice. But what I ended up writing her back today is something that was one of the more interesting avenues of research that has not been picked up, that I think most people now are not thinking about it at all, and I doubt your generation would even know about it. But this was in 1970. This was Stan Grof, the world's leading LSD researcher and theoretician, and Walter Pahnke, who was a minister, a doctor, and a PhD. Walter had done the Good Friday experiment. And so this is Stan Grof's session account of his LSD session from 1970. Walter Pahnke was the experimenter. Stan was wired up to EEGs and all this equipment, monitoring his heart rate and all this stuff. But the purpose of it was for them to do ESP experiments while Stan was in an LSD state. And, you know, he writes about how he started getting a bunch of them right. And he felt like he could really understand. He could pick up information this other way. And, you know, and he ended up getting three in a row of this, you know, reading these cards. And then he said, oh, this was not really the spiritual thing. This was just like a parlor trick, you know, that he should think more spiritually. And so he gave it up. So from retrospect, you know, it would have been better if he would have done it 10 times, you know, three times could be just lucky. The odds of getting 10 times in a row would have been astronomically small. All right, so it's just to say that psychedelics have been used as tools to study the mind in terms of neuroscience, tools to study how to enhance psychotherapy for a range of different things, tools to study ESP, and the other area that we're starting to look at just in very early stages is the mind-body connection through like fibromyalgia or irritable bowel syndrome or other pain, various ways in which psychedelics can be used in therapy for treating not just mental illnesses like depression, anxiety, PTSD, things like that, but more mind-body connections. I think that's really exciting. And then I think that the thing that your generation does know is more like, group parties with psychedelics, with dancing and all of this. And, you know, that did begin a lot with the Merry Pranksters, the Acid Test, the Grateful Dead. And I'm glad to see that that has continued. But I think that the other part I would just say from your generation's perspective is that there was a period of time when these were not controversial things. There was all this discussion about psychedelics and spirituality and mystical experiences and therapy and understanding the brain. And, you know, so from the, you know, 50s through the a big part of the 60s, you know, this was like one of the most important areas of research in psychiatry. And it only became more controversial kind of as a backlash to a lot of the secret military CIA mind control stuff. Ken Kesey, who is really the you know, founder of the Merry Pranksters, the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, that it was at these acid tests that the Grateful Dead began. You know, he took LSD in a CIA experiment at Stanford. And he thought, wow, there's a lot more to this drug than, you know, they're letting on. So
yeah.
I think that this idea that there was a period of time when this was not controversial. And so that's what we're liking. That's where we're working to get back to. And what I've often said is that the way that you evaluate your success is when it gets taken for granted. Like in America, it's not this way around the world. But in America, a lot of people don't realize that it's pretty recent that women could even vote.
Right. Yeah. You know? Yeah. You know? That's right.
But we take it for granted. Yeah. So we take it for granted. So that's the goal that we have. We want this to be taken for granted. That oh yeah, there's 5,000 psychedelic treatment centers around the U.S. and Canada, or more. You know, and then, oh, there's my corner psychedelic therapy session. Yeah, okay. My treatment center.
Yeah, we have something similar in Vancouver. It feels like that with the dispensaries that have opened up. There's like 5, 6, 7, 8 now dispensaries that are just casually selling psilocybin products and other stuff. Dana Larson's store, which is almost absurd, but feels normal right now. I just go down to the corner. It's actually not too far from where I'm at right now. If I want to, within 10 minutes, I could go get psilocybin if I wanted to, which is a weird contrast because on that hand, that exists in Vancouver, sort of its own maybe unique bubble in certain ways, but following a larger trend. At the same time, you know, I have my own YouTube channel outside of the Maps Canada YouTube channel where I speak about psychedelics and advocate and share information. And I got stopped at the border and they actually found my YouTube channel and they really did not like it. I think I mentioned that I had it and the dude said, oh, what's your channel name? And instantly I'm like, oh no, I just posted a video about MDMA. And he looked it up and he said, MDMA got me a girlfriend? You took MDMA? I'm like, uh-oh. That was the video was about overcoming some fears and doubts around relationships and things like that. And when he said that, his colleagues next to him all turned. They're like, what's going on? Like, how'd that go? And then, like, when he's like going through the videos, someone comes over, looks over his shoulder, looks down, like, and then walks away. I'm like, oh, no, what have I done? Good news. Wow. I didn't get permanently banned from the U.S. like he said might happen. thankfully. So I should be able to go to the psychedelic science conferences if there is an issue. But it's cool information because they officially will not, at least this guy didn't use his discretion to ban me from the U.S. for having made a video explaining how I had taken MDMA before.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Did he let you into the country at that time or no?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
After searching my phone, though, they were looking for any evidence of addiction or intention to use in the U.S., and they didn't find anything.
Wow.
It was close, though. It was really close. So. Well, and then I come back home.
Do you know the story about Andrew Feldmar?
I don't.
Oh, okay. So this is years ago. So we're trying to start MDMA research in Vancouver, both for phase two and also for phase three. So Ingrid Pacey, who's a psychiatrist and who's been trained with Stan Grof and the holotropic breathwork, she's a psychiatrist in Canada, and she wanted to do this in Vancouver. And we're great. But we use a two-person team, usually male-female. And so we're trying to figure out who might be her male partner and doing this research. And we couldn't find one for a while. So then, lo and behold, there was an article in the New York Times about this guy, Andrew Feldmar, that was crossing the border in Vancouver, and the customs people checked it out, and he'd written things years before about his use of psychedelics. And, you know, he spoke about it highly. And they banned him from the country and refused to let him in the U.S., even though he had children in the U.S. and had come back multiple times. He was a respected clinical psychologist. And so this New York Times article was just outrageous. But I'm like, oh, great, Andrew Feldmar, you're from Vancouver. You've got all this experience as a therapist. You've got all this experience with psychedelics. So I called him up and I said, would you like to fight back? Would you like us to talk about the value of MDMA research, the value of psychedelic research? And, you know, we could maybe try to help you get back into the U.S. And he said, no, he's done with the U.S. He's not going to come. But he would like to help us by participating in the research. So he offered to become the co-therapist for Ingrid. And he was identified for us, found for us by the customs people, who did the same thing that they did for you, but they actually were worse and blocked him from coming to the U.S. and banned him from the country.
Yeah, well, glad some good came out of that. I'm glad I made it through, and I hope I'll make it through again for psychedelic science. I'm driving down, so I'm going to be bringing some Tim Hortons coffee and maple syrup for our MAPS Canada Canadian meetup that'll be happening at some point.
Great, so, great.
Authentic Canadian experience if you'd like to stop by.
yeah
for that. We'll see how that works out, but yeah, is there anything else that we missed that you want to share before we wrap up?
I do, and you know, we just talked about this conflict. I just want to talk about something that we do that's, you know, early stages but super interesting. And this is, there are Israelis and Palestinians that are doing MDMA and ayahuasca together as a way to try to break down barriers and try to see their commonality. And we work with a neuroscientist, Leo Roseman, at the Imperial College in England. He's an Israeli, and he's done work on interviewing these people, why they do it, and also he's taken a group of Israelis and Palestinians to Spain for a group ayahuasca experience with a lot of metrics, evaluations before and after. And so he will report the results at Psychedelic Science. And we are now trying to develop metrics to figure out how to do a study to bring a group of Israelis and Palestinians to Spain for a group MDMA experience and to see if they have less prejudice, more open to the other, more trust, things like that. So I just want to say that there is this general focus on mental illness and treating PTSD and all of this. And that, you know, there are many, many other applications, including, as you said, like couples therapy or just, you know, getting over shyness, certain things like that for relationships, but also relationships between cultures that are in conflict and that we'd like to explore. Just for that, to people to keep in mind that psychedelics are tools that have so many, many different uses that if we can mature as a culture and figure out how to develop them. And, you know, Stan Grof, I'll just say, has talked about how, you know, psychedelics used wisely and with care are like the telescope to astronomy and the microscope to biology and medicine. And, you know, the telescope was controversial in its day when Galileo died under house arrest, and you upset the religious views of the day that the Earth is the center of the universe. And psychedelics are controversial, but we think less so. Again, we want them to be taken granted, think of as a tool deep to help us study the mind, to help humans survive. And so I just wanted to add that little bit. And so and also to invite people to psychedelic science. It's going to be the place to really understand what's going on with the entire field and also to look forward and think about what we can do over the next couple of years.
And the celebrations. I'm excited to be part of that.
Yeah.
And something to add that's interesting about the Galileo thing is there's this general perception that he was persecuted for his scientific views, but there was also, he had a very, like, as I understand it, very like militant anti-religious view. He's very much like an advocate against the status quo in a non-reform, more like an anti-perspective. And so MAPS is more of, It's like there's a parallel there, but we also see how there's a benefit to working with the current system to incorporate new tools and technologies. And he did not do that. So that's Galileo.
Well, there's another. Oh, yes. Okay. So you brought it now to, do you remember Father Bruno? Do you know that's? Okay. So Father Bruno was a follower of Galileo. You know, he was a Catholic. And he believed Copernicus. He believed Galileo. And apparently he was also interested in plant medicines. Oh. And he was hauled before the Inquisition. And he was sentenced to burn at the stake because he would not recant. And what he said was one of the most courageous things ever to the Spanish Inquisition. He said, this is after he's been sentenced to burn at the stake. He says, "Your fear in sentencing me is greater than my fear in being sentenced."
Wow.
That their whole worldview was so weak that they had to kill people so that they wouldn't have to have these doubts. So, terrible situation.
Wow.
So we ended on that, and I think the Psychedelic Science Conference is trying to banish fear, replace fear with hope, and I think that's really what we can celebrate.
Absolutely. Celebratory use of psychedelics, celebratory events at Psychedelic Science, lots of things to celebrate, lots of things to look forward to. People can check out the links in the description for more information on what's going on with that. And thank you for being on, Rick. This is a pleasure and an honor.
Yeah. It is a pleasure, Luke. And I'm really glad to see everything that MAPS Canada is doing and the work now that you're helping with public education. Super wonderful.
Amazing. Awesome. Well, thank you.